Hello, and welcome to Spartan Speak, a podcast from the Lansing State Journal and Detroit Free Press focused on Michigan State sports. I'm Phil Friend, your host, podcast producer, and sports writer for the LSJ, joined by Freebie writer Chris Solari and LSJ sports columnist Graham Couch. Well, guys, how are you guys doing out there? It is Tuesday afternoon. We are recording right now. We are less than 24 hours removed from the official end of the college football season, where we saw Alabama beat up Ohio State pretty good, to put it nicely. And I know it's I don't know if it's a referendum on the Big Ten or the rest of college football in general, but yeah, Alabama just continues to be the class of college football.
Yeah, holy smokes. I mean, you watch an Ohio State team that beat MSU 52-12 or whatever that was, and get taken out like that. And I mean, you know, it was a weird year because none of the teams at the top had traditionally great defenses. So it exacerbated great offense. This wasn't a classic Ohio State defense or even a classic Alabama defense, but it's a reminder of, to me, like, I mean, you think about the MSU football season we just watched, and then you watch Devontae Smith run around people, and you go, well, I don't know. It might be a while before they're playing at that level. I would love this is why I want an 18 playoff, though. I would like to see other teams invited to the party. I think that would, over time, help recruiting, help, and you know, just somebody gets a shot at some point, they're going to knock somebody off. It allows for some program rotation. You know, Clemson wasn't always the god of college football. Alabama had some down times pre-Saban. Things don't last forever. And the four-team playoff helps solidify what is now. And I think the eight-teamer or a six-teamer, whatever it might be, would help, you know, get some variety in there.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on that. And I've been a proponent of the eight-game or eight-team playoff the whole time, just simply because I think four is still handpicking and you end up a lot of sour grapes from a lot of conferences. I mean, if you got a Power Five group of conferences and you only have four teams going in there, and a lot of times it ends up being two SEC teams, that's not really what this was intended to do. I mean, if you're trying to find the best team, you know, eyeball test can only go so far. I mean, you know, no one would have saw Ohio State doing what they did to Clemson this year based just simply on an eyeball test, I don't believe. But yeah, I mean, you know, in spinning that back towards Michigan State, I mean, what was it? How many did Alabama get? 52 last night on Ohio State? Is that right? Is that my numbers right on that? Because Michigan State in the last four games against Ohio State has put up 39 points in four years. So I'm writing something for Wednesday about just how that, I mean, we've seen that around the country. You know, we've seen offensive numbers go up, and obviously, you know, the last two games, or that's not even counting this year's game against Ohio State. You know, that's from 2015 to 2018. So there's a couple of years missing in that, but in that 39 points. But the fact that, you know, Michigan State has struggled to score points, and, you know, you're talking epic levels of offensive drought. I think, you know, the downturn in Michigan State's offense coincided with the uptick in offenses around the country, and you're not going to be able to win anymore those 17-16 type games or 17-14 like they did in 2015. I mean, you've got to be able to put points on the board in this. And it's, you know, what ended up ultimately being the demise of Mark Antonio's program is now the challenge for Mel Tucker to fix. And you know, it's going to be, to me, I mean, it's that until you fix the offense, until you get to that point, any talk of even a Big Ten championship is moot.
And I think one of the things that'll get interesting is, you know, you think about Michigan State. Michigan State's had the Devontae Smiths in their history. They had Charles Rogers. They have T.J. Duckett. They've had guys, Plaxico Burress, who were that elite receiver. And the top guys in the D'Antonio era at their best, the best of Tony Lippett, the best of Aaron Burbridge, were close. But one of the things that I think is going to help, and I think this is something that sort of an alternative take on the idea of the name, image, and likeness, I think that could help spread things out. You know, you go to Alabama and you're one of six dudes, and I understand there's a lot of Alabama stuff that can, but you know, you go to a school where you stand out, where you're the star, You know, Cedric Ervin at Michigan State doesn't have to wait his turn. He scores four touchdowns in his opener against Purdue. At Alabama, he's a four or five-star kid who, you know, waits a couple of years like most of their backs do. And I think that ultimately could be an advantage for kids who want to separate themselves and be seen. And that could help places like MSU, you know, you recruit to, we will feature you. But ultimately, you've also got to prove to kids that you know how to feature them. I thought that hurt D'Antonio at the end. You know, they did not have, like, they did a little bit with Felton Davis his final year, but they really struggled to take their best players, their best receivers, and create matchups for them. That was just not a staff that did that well. And, you know, I think MSU did that a little bit better this year. I think we saw that with Jalen Naylor, and we saw it at times with Jaden Reed, and we'll see the growth of those two guys. But, I think that's something you have to show, because when you can do that, you know, I'm going to – this reference is going to come way too early in this podcast, the obligatory Western Michigan reference. But, I mean, that is ultimately, you know, when I first got there, and they had some great receivers who played in the NFL before that a little bit, but they had Greg Jennings, who played a long time in the NFL, but they featured him. He had 98 catches as a senior, was a dominating player, and it led to other guys coming in who broke all of his records, and guys who, none of which were quite as good as him, but they saw the opportunity. It became, and so Michigan State, I think their football program could really use somebody to really break out and be used well, and, you know, and show that to recruit.
No, there's absolutely truth to that. And you know, I mean, listen, you know, a guy like KJ Hamler would have been a perfect guy for that, right? But Michigan State couldn't keep him in state. So, you know, that ultimately, when you look at that, I mean, there are kids from the state of Michigan who have, in the last 5 years, 6 years, been those type of players. It's just getting them to East Lansing that has been the problem, and that's ultimately where Mel Tucker's challenge is to resell those kids. You know, the guy, I mean, even like you remember early on in Mark Antonio's tenure when he had Devin Thomas, and, you know, turned him, and he blossomed as an offensive star. And but the offense in the end of that D'Antonio era, you know, was troublesome. I mean, you know, that I went back and redid the math on the Ohio State thing just now while Graham was talking. They scored, in the last six games against Ohio State, they scored 64 points. And until you can score points against Ohio State, maybe not necessarily at the level of what exactly Alabama did, because I'm not sure if you can get there in the short term, but until you can get back to that point in 2014 where you're putting up 30-plus points, you know, you're not going to compete. And, you know, it's just, it's a different era, and Ohio State's recruiting from an offensive standpoint at an elite level with players that can score 40, 50 points a game and with no problem.
I'll say this, though. The Michigan State defense of 2013, and now that's a hard defense to duplicate, right? That's the greatest defense in modern MSU football history. But the defense of 2013 was significantly better, in my view, than anything we saw in the playoff from Alabama, Clemson, or Ohio State that didn't have great defenses this year. So I'm not saying you've got to build a great offense. A great defense in modern football does not, you know, you look at the way Michigan State beat a very good Ohio State team with Braxton Miller and Carlos Hyde and those guys in that Big Ten championship game. Yeah, they were great defensively, but they ultimately – it was their ability to bounce back and score again and score and like they did, and that offense find itself. But I do think there's a place where you don't give up 50 to Bama, where you're so physical and disruptive. And not every, even Bama by their standards, is not always going to have Devontae Smith, right? That's a different caliber dude. But there's still an opportunity to make your mark on that end. But I agree, once you get there, you're going to have to be, you know, you're going to have to be special on the offensive side.
It just takes so much. I mean, if you just look at the Big Ten this year, what your best bet is to combine Northwestern's defense and a Michael Penix Indiana offense. That's the team you need, except you need that year in and year out to compete with the Ohio State, Alabama, Clemson triumvirate up there.
Yeah, but it's hard. I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
You know,
it's impossible to do year in and year out.
I mean, you say that, and you know, a year ago, Northwestern lost 34-3 to that Indiana team. So I mean, you know that, but it can change in a hurry. I mean, you saw that with Northwestern going 3-8 2 years ago in 2019. I guess it's 2 years ago now. It's hard to believe we flipped the calendar, but yeah, I mean, that's ultimately, you know, the question is, are those great defenses going to be enough anymore?
Not on their own. Right. No,
I don't. I mean, the pendulum will swing again at some point. That's just the nature of college football. But I mean,
maybe though.
The last two decades, though, the average mean score, I was kind of looking, doing some research on this. The average mean score continues to go upward. And that's in part because to borrow from another sport in a ad commercial, chicks dig the long ball. And, you know, that's what sells. The scoring points keeps people watching games. No one wants to watch a 6-3 game, even if there's beauty in that.
Right. You can't and you can't hit people like you could. And I remember even during the MSU run, you know, the rules with targeting changed and all that. And I remember watching a early August practice when Narduzzi was still there, where they were teaching kids to take out knees, and that had changed. It was get lower, get lower, get lower. You can't hit people in the head. You can't hit people up here. You can't spear this. Which is, you know, obviously if you poll football players, they'd rather have the concussion than the knee injury any day of the week. But still, it you know, the rules have changed around offense. The offense have gotten more sophisticated. You give me most 1980s football coaches, and I'll give you 10 football coaches in every community in the high school who could offensively coach circles around them. The world changes. The offenses evolve, right? It's just it's a different sport than it used to be. And so I think that's a big part of it. And for you got to have a quarterback. What did all these teams have? They have a quarterback. And what do they have? They have playmakers on the outside. You bring up Indiana, and they had two, and Freifogel and Watt Fillier, you know, two really elite receivers with an elite quarterback most of the year. And they couldn't run the football either, and that's ultimately was the difference, I think, against Ohio State, because I think they were as good as Ohio State defensively. But they couldn't, you know, at the line of scrimmage up front offensively, they weren't as good. So for MSU, they've got to hit on one of these quarterbacks. Maybe it's Peyton Thorne. Maybe it's Hampton Faye. Maybe it's somebody else. But at some point, you've got to have a guy who can is special back there if you're going to be special. And then, you know, because I actually think their offensive playmakers at receiver have a chance to be pretty dang good collectively and individually to some degree as they move on.
Yeah, I mean, those guys are out there. I mean, even Mac Jones was only a 3-star, you know, recruit. And I don't know what Zach Wilson or the Coastal Carolina QB were ranking rankings, but I can't imagine they were up there since they're not at a major program. I mean, those guys are out there. You just got to, you know, your recruiting staff, and when you're breaking that film, you've just got to be able to find those guys. I know that's very simple, the way I phrase that. But, I mean, they're out there.
But what keeps them talented and what keeps them productive at the college level is elite level offensive linemen keeping them upright. And I'll tell you what, the other thing that I don't think people realize how much DeVonta Smith benefited this year from in watching Alabama, as little as I did, but their outside receivers are blocking machines. And that's a Nick Saban specialty. And that was, you know, something that Mark D'Antonio focused on significantly early in his tenure. But if you can't block the edge with your receivers, you're not going to be able to spring a guy like that, no matter how talented he is. I mean, yes, he can make plays himself, but you watch those edge blocking receivers that Alabama had in that game against Ohio State. They freed him. They freed him a lot for yards after catch. And, you know, that it's easy as a quarterback, if you got the time and you're just throwing the ball down the line of scrimmage, to let a guy do that if you got guys blocking for you in front of you and outside.
Well, let's shift course here to basketball, unless you guys have anything else you want to share.
MSU's a long way away. I think that's where, where we're at.
It's okay. Spring practice starts soon, right?
Hope everybody just skipped the first 15 minutes of the podcast and just the thing Graham just said. That's all you need to know. But so we're kind of like in a little bit of a spot here for Michigan State basketball in terms of we are 4 days removed from the loss to Purdue, and we got a couple, 2 days to be exact, until the Iowa game. So we kind of thought this would be a good time to kind of do a State of the Union or State of the State or State of the Michigan State basketball program type conversation. I think, you know, before the Purdue game on Friday, I think spirits are pretty high. It looked like the Spartans maybe have found what they were going for after beating Rutgers, and then after the first half and then the first couple minutes of the second half against Purdue, where they were up 33-16, I think was the high water mark. And then all of a sudden everything kind of fell apart quickly. You only scored 2 field goals in the last 15:42 of the game, and all of a sudden you can't stop Trevion Williams down in the paint. Now we're asking all of the questions we were asking before, if not more. So Chris, I'll have you kick off this discussion. I mean, how do you see this team right now? Where do you feel they are, and are they not as far along as we thought they would be or should be, considering the depth that we thought they had and how much talent is on this roster?
Yeah, they went 12-01 without a field goal in that second half. You know, before finally getting Joey Hauser to hit one from outside. And I think, you know, the difference between the beginning of the year and now, to me, are the two guys that are supposed to be the guys in Hauser and Watts. I mean, you know, we can kind of shuffle around all the other problems that are there with, you know, giving up the inside and you know, running small lineups at Trevion Williams, and how are you going to do it against guys like Luka Garza and Trace Jackson Davis. But ultimately, it's the same thing as we just talked about with football. You got to be able to score the ball. And those are the guys that are supposed to be scorers, and they've gone MIA. And, you know, Watts, they're moving him back and forth between shooting guard and point guard. He looks lost. I don't know if it's a lack of understanding of what his role is, a lack of understanding of the offensive sets, or what it is, but he just looks like a different guy. He doesn't look anywhere near as confident as he was even last year when he was missing shots. I mean, people forget how big his struggles were really through the first half of the year. And then he started to kind of find a role. It helps to have a Cassius Winston delivering the ball to you and being the primary scorer and really being the third or fourth option. But, you know, that's the big thing. They need him to be a scorer, and, you know, they need him to penetrate and get to the basket and score and be able not fire up random wild shots. And I think the same with Hauser. You know, Hauser right now is, I think, so fixated on shooting the three that it's detrimental. And I mean, you know, part of the reason you're seeing, you know, yeah, the turnovers are a problem, but those long rebounds are ending up in breakouts the other way as well. So to me, though, and then Graham, I mean, I'm curious to you. I mean, I think Aaron Henry's been what you need Aaron Henry to be, and maybe sometimes a little bit more than that, but those are the two guys that this team needs right now to right the ship.
Yeah, because what was so disheartening for MSU in a way was they had these two games where they played well enough against Nebraska, and Nebraska's Nebraska, so you never really know. But, you know, they needed that win badly, and then they have what I thought was a very good performance. Aaron Henry was exceptional and efficient. Some other guys got going against Rutgers. They didn't shoot well, but they defended well, and they were able to get out and run. And then you have this game that is sort of a great litmus test for some of the challenges ahead, with a big man who's dominant, but maybe the overall roster isn't as talented as Illinois or Michigan or Iowa. And so I think the reason that Purdue game is so disheartening is it shouldn't have happened that way. And what you needed to find out about your guys, you didn't let find out in certain ways. Like, they needed to play those four bigs and figure out which one of these guys or if any of them were best served against a Trevion Williams type. They needed to figure out in the half court, could they do some things? Because that's what they haven't had to do. I mean, they were able to run against Rutgers because Rutgers was missing shots. They were able to run against Nebraska because Nebraska is defensively less. I agree wholeheartedly with Chris on Rocket Watts. Like, that's the dude that potentially makes them different in some ways. And they need to find a way, and even if they lose games doing it, they need to ride him and let him figure it out and just let Rocket Watts. Obviously, you got to hold a guy accountable to an extent, but what I mean is if he's struggling but playing hard, let him struggle out of it. I will disagree a little on Hauser. I think they got to get him off the low block. That's not working with the bigger guys. And I think his the three-point shot and using him on pick and pops can be a more efficient way in most matchups. What's going to be fascinating, though, is it's pretty clear they don't have a big guy who can hold up. And so you're going to have to throw all four big guys and allow certain matchups and how guys are playing to dictate, and I think Izzo lost faith in those guys early in the second half, and I think he wrongfully went completely away from them because they had hung in there a little bit in the first half, and I think that wound up biting him. But it was a real telling sign that if you're playing Trevion Williams in a Purdue team that's pretty average and you're bailing on what your bigs completely, you're in a whole world of hurt and trouble when you go up against what's coming down with Iowa, Michigan, and Illinois.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because I think that, you know, you look at those first four games in the Big Ten, how much they struggled with defending the three. That they didn't really – I mean, a guy like Pete Nance even was still scoring on them in the paint and really had his way in that first game against Northwestern. They really haven't had even a Trevion Williams type to have to play, and you got Garza coming up. But I think it was an interesting – component to what Izzo was saying about not getting beaten by the three, because they've been beaten by the three so much. And even in the Nebraska game, they gave up a lot of threes. And you saw them focus on that against Rutgers. And Rutgers obviously was without their one big man in that game, so that changed the dynamic a little bit. But if you're worried about that with a lead late, then that's going to be an issue, right? I mean, you've got to, in some ways, pick your poison. And, I don't know. I mean, a guy like Garza could go off for 40. Do you give him 40 and try and shut everybody else down? That's going to be an interesting dynamic, I think, on Thursday to kind of watch. And I don't know if that's maybe the right way to approach it. But, I mean, if your focus is not getting beaten by the three, you don't want Jordan Bohannon and Wieskamp beating you. If you say, you know what Garza's going to do, almost the Jordan type rules, let Garza get his inside, but don't give up the twos versus the threes. But if you don't have, I mean, let's face it, Marcus Bingham physically has not been sturdy. He's blocked some shots, but he's getting pushed out of the way. I think Hauser's getting back down. I just think that combination of Hauser and Malik Hall over the last 8-10 of that game had moments where they looked good, but I think that that punishment that you take in the paint, you got to have that rotation there. You can't forget that Thomas Kithier is on your bench, even if he does have four fouls. You can't forget that you got Bingham and Sissoko there to provide some long and length, some length to disrupt shots. So I don't know. I'm just really curious to see how things. I mean, I'm curious to see if Izzo even changes his lineup to face Garza in some ways down low after that game. And how much do you sacrifice on the perimeter if you do that?
Well, and the problem with this now is Garza's become nearly a 50% three-point shooter. And that's he is a big challenge overall. And so, you're right, because in the first 2 years you could say, Garza gets 30, but you're able to contain the rest of the team. Do you lose? Well, Garza may get 40 on you, and it may include threes, and it may stretch defenses and create other issues. Like, he is a problem.
I was just going to say he's leading the country in scoring now, I think at like 27-6 a game. You think about that. He was a National Player of the Year candidate last year. Now I'd say he's probably up there as a front runner.
Yes, I also their roster offensively, Wieskamp and Bohannon and those guys. I mean, they can score on you. Now Iowa's still Iowa, right? I mean, they still defend at a mediocre level, and they want to run. And so those two, I don't hate this matchup in certain ways for Michigan State. Because Michigan State, if you're not a great defensive team and you're willing to run with them, if Michigan State can get them to miss some shots and get going, I mean, I think MSU can hang in this game. And the thing about MSU is they're certainly not matchup proof. We've learned that. But against certain matchups, they can play with anybody in the country in terms of, you know, touted teams, I think. And we'll find out if that includes this one. Like I'm a little skeptical on what they're going to be able to do inside. And the thing that I thought was also disheartening against Purdue is, you know, the idea is if you're going to go small, that you're going to be able to hurt the other team with your, like, they got to guard you now, right? And that sort of thing. The problem against Purdue is when you go Hauser Hall small, you know, Hall is a really effective player because he can defend a two guard. He can defend a center to some degree. I mean, I like him on the court in a lot of ways, but offensively, he's not consistent or great. He doesn't scare you at all. And so if he's, you know, he's not somebody that the other team has to go, shoot, how do we account for that? They're going small. And so that, you know, for Michigan State to be really effective small, they would have to go like Aaron Henry at the four, Hauser at the five, to me, to be effective offensively small, countering what another team was doing. And that, you know, I don't know if that makes sense or if that's something they'll ever get to. But that, I don't think that happens with Malik Hall right now.
Well, and I think another component of that too is, you know, where's Gabe Brown in all this? You know, because, you know, if you're able to get Gabe Brown in there, that changes your athleticism and the ability to run. And how they can defend you, but it just seems like he's still not getting it on the defensive side, which ultimately is going to land you on the pine in important moments. And I think that's, you mentioned about, you know, Hall at the four and Henry at the five. Well, who are your three guards right now then? Hogard and Langford and Watts? They've got problems at all five spots in some respect. Right now, I mean, maybe, you know, and not necessarily because of Henry, but just simply what the best fit for Henry with the guys around him is. You know, I mean, is he the three? Is he the two? Is he the four? You know, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, do you go big with him at the two? It's, you know, there's components. You know, Langford at times looks like he's an offensive force, and at times he vanishes. Same on the defensive side, too. I think that he's played a little better defensively the last two games, but still, you know, he gets taken off the dribble, and so does Watts, and, you know, so does Lawyer, so does Hogard. So, you know, you're kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't moment here if you're a defensive-minded coach like Izzo, right?
Yeah, and part of the problem, I think, for these guys is you know, Izzo's staff, Izzo is a Hall of Fame defensive coach. Like, it's one of those things where you can sort of trust they'll figure it out on that end if it's possible to figure it out with this team. And so you can say, yeah, he screwed up against Purdue, should have had a bigger guy on the line there for that rebound, should have had more length against Travion Williams in the final shot, although Bingham was your only option because Kithier isn't any longer, and even if he'd be in the right place. And Sissoko would have fouled him without question, and Marble would have fouled him, would have stuck his forearm right through his rib cage, and so
Marble might have two fouls on the play.
Yeah, right. So that, you know, your options are were to some degree limited, but it is not a staff that is offensively innovative. It never really has been. They, you know, Nick Ward got hurt, and they got lucky he did 2 years ago because they sort of stumbled into this great pick and roll offense that worked with Cassius Winston and Xavier Tillman, and so that, you know, they don't have a the guy used to be an assistant, went on to coach at Utah. Blanking Boylan? Right now. What's that? Jim Boylan. Yeah, they don't have a Jimmy Boylan right now, right? They don't have that guy. Like, and Fife comes from a motion background. They don't, you know, I don't know that they're able to really always maximize the best of what they have offensively. And usually they get there, but they don't have, you know, John Beilein would be an amazing consultant for this staff right now. That's what I would say.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny you mentioned too, because I think that as much as everybody laments loss of Cassius Winston, the loss of Tillman on both ends is so glaring right now, because, you know, if those guards are getting taken off the dribble like that, well, Tillman's back there as a defender positionally and as a shot blocker and alterer. You know, in terms of help, I don't know if there's anybody. I mean, he's one of the better help defenders that they've had in that program, and they're lacking that right now. I mean, guys are a step slow and sliding over, and then on the offensive end, because of his court vision, because of his ability to pass the ball, not only do you use him in that pick and roll, but you could use that motion offense that was working so well. And I think on the offensive end, they're just struggling to find an identity of, you know, do you continue that motion offense? Do you go to that two-man game that they showed against Rutgers with Watts and Hauser? I think that's just kind of a learning process right now. I mean, that two-man offense was always part of their game, even with the motion, right? But it was within the construct of that, and the ball moved so well because those two guys who were running the pick and roll with Winston and Tillman both could see the court. I mean, how many times did you see Tillman get a pass on the cut and then go cross lane with a bounce pass or something to an open guy as he got a double? I mean, you know, there's a lot of things like that Tillman brought, that those four guys that are occupying that five spot right now, and I think occupying is probably the best word, they don't bring that. And that changes some of your dynamics. So, I don't know. Izzo said he expected mid-January to be kind of the target to figure this team out. I think he's still probably figuring in some ways. But that makes Thursday all the more vital because, you know, what, they got Indiana on Sunday, and they've got a couple more tough games down the stretch with Ohio State and Rutgers before playing Michigan in early February. So, you know, these next 2 weeks are the most critical, starting with this game.
I want to bring up Marcus Brigham here for a second. Chris, you mentioned him a little while back about, you know, he actually played pretty good in the first half against Purdue, and then I don't think he saw the court again in the final 15 minutes. And I just kind of wanted to be like, you know, that's a pretty good sign that, boy, they haven't even come close to figuring out their center rotation yet, and I don't know when/if they're going to anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't know. And what I thought at halftime was, what was very clear, because the Big Ten is a gauntlet of centers, right, is it's going to take all four guys for different reasons, different moments. And you want to throw different looks. I mean, the Mati Sissoko is going to come in. He's going to rim protect. He's going to get in people's heads a little bit. He might foul you. He's got five fouls to give. So be it. Play him. Make him part of the rotation. You can't play him forever. You can't play him in big moments because he might foul you. Offensively, he doesn't give you much. Marble has got to stop thinking this is football with his forearms and just play with his feet, because he's got great feet, and that's kind of weird. Kithier is the guy you can count on, you know, but you're going to have matchups that are tough on him. And Bingham is the guy who hasn't developed, who's, I think, infuriating. And when you look at that junior class, and, you know, Chris wrote about this junior class heading into the season. When you look at the junior class, this is a performance year. It is Marcus Bingham, Foster Lawyer, Gabe Brown, Aaron Henry, and am I missing? Thomas Kithier. Kithier is playing to the level they recruited him, right? Aaron Henry is playing to the level they recruited him. Those two guys, not disappointments at all. The other three guys, though, I mean, Lawyer, I think, is playing to some degree to his ceiling. I don't know that they would recruit him if they had to do it over again. Gabe Brown is not. And Gabe Brown has been, I had high hopes for him, and it is not gone as they hoped. And I still think he could be an effective player. But is he looking over his shoulder? I don't know that Langford coming back helped him. He gets lost defensively still. And Lawyer, you know, Lawyer was a prolific shooter at one point. I don't know why he's not shooting. Who's telling him not to shoot? Or if he just doesn't think he should. But that man should be greenlit inside 30 feet. And that should be something that is part of what they have. He is a special, special shooter in his day and a pure shooter. And they got to tap into that a little bit. Otherwise, when he's out there, he's much less effective.
Well, you can't shoot the ball if you can't hold the ball, and that's part of the problem. I mean, you know, you saw him dribble off his leg again and fall down out of bounds. I mean, you know, the athleticism of the guards that he's facing is significantly higher than he placed at Clarkson. And I think that's, you know, I mean, is he 6 foot? I mean, that's they list him at, but, you know, it might be a stretch. And if you're not 6 foot, you better have elite quickness, elite ball handling skills, elite moves to free yourself up in some ways. And I don't necessarily see that. I think he's a good leader for this team, but you know, the fact that, you know, he's been pigeonholed into a 10 to 15 minute a roll game. First, I think tells you the worry that they have about him on the defensive end, but also that they can't expect that much from him offensively. And I think what's interesting too, along with that, there was a point in that game where Izzo had both him and Rocket Watts in at the same time. And that was, I mean, they both committed big turnovers in a early run after they were up 17 for Purdue. So, you know, if it's going the other way with both those guys on the court together, then how do you figure them in? I mean, you know, right now, you know, Hogard looks like the only point guard on that team. And that's trouble because he just played 38 minutes a game.
Yeah, I mean, Hogard coming in lessens Lawyer. But when Lawyer's out there, he's got to shoot. That's what he does at a Division I level, is he shoots. And at a Big Ten level. And so he passes up open looks. He does. He gets by somebody, and he's pretty decent at creating that, and he gets to the 15 feet, and he doesn't let it go. To me, if he gets a look, he's got to let it go. But you're right. You do start with the Hogard thing. While I totally agree with doing it at this point, obviously inserts another 20 to 25 minutes a game from somebody else that gets taken out of that rotation. And right now it's largely been Rocket Watts and Lawyer to some degree. But you're not, if you're playing Rocket Watts 15 a game, you're not going to win anything big. And so right. You have to figure out that over time. He's not only got to get going, but he's going to have to be a 25-minute-a-game guy at least. And so that'll be interesting to watch here is a sort of that rotation. Somebody's going to get squeezed out a little bit. And it may be Gabe Brown. I think that's too bad because I think Gabe Brown, I thought, was going to help that ceiling. And every once in a while, he'll have these moments where he'll hit a couple threes or he'll come in with a dunk and he's athletic. And everybody, you know, and I think part of the problem for Gabe Brown, this was a very much a beloved team 2 years ago, right? Everybody loved. It just seemed like a group of nice guys who found it. They really related to this team. And that was partly, and then Cassius' story last year. And Cassius was a guy, easy guy to like. Tillman was a guy to like. And they won with this group of freshmen and sophomores. Like, people loved Gabe Brown on the sidelines. They loved his potential. It's turned into frustration a little bit. And I get it. Gabe Brown is not. But that said, Gabe Brown's opportunities, like I do wonder if Gabe Brown had, if Joshua Langford had not come back, what Gabe Brown's season would look like. And that's not, you know, again, I'm not saying they should be playing Gabe Brown over Joshua Langford. I don't think from what we've seen with Gabe Brown, he's earned that. And, you know, I did a breakdown at one point before they had beaten Nebraska of the 8 determining moments in the season, I thought, which were 3 real positive runs against Notre Dame, Duke, and Wisconsin, and 5 negative runs that had created their losses. And it was what was the things, obviously, like any data, it's inexact and it's not all determining. But what was very interesting is Langford was on the court for almost every positive run they'd had, every minute of positive run, like 90% of it. And for a guy like Gabe Brown, he was only on the court for less than 30% of the time things were going well, and most of the time things were going poorly. And so that tells you something, right? Because we don't always know why something didn't work defensively or went wrong or whatever. But if a guy is always on the court when stuff's going wrong, there's something to that usually.
Yeah, and you know, I think one of the things that we need to talk about maybe is the last maybe 15 seconds of that Purdue game. Because you talk about when things are starting to go wrong. I mean, Rocket Watts is becoming one of those guys. I mean, you know, the inbound pass under the basket, first the foul. I mean, the foul was brutal. I mean, you can't put yourself in a position, right or wrong, whether the call or not, to where a ref can blow a whistle on that when you got the lead. But then the inbound pass, I mean, that's a situation. I don't know who you put the blame on. I mean, that's a point guard situation that your first and only priority is catch the ball and get fouled, right? And Watts couldn't do that. And that's, whether you want to call that Watts' fault or Izzo's fault for not putting Hogard back in that situation, worrying about the free throw. You got to get the ball first before you can get to the line. And now you give Purdue the ball under their basket again. There's a lot of things that, in that Purdue game that, you know, that I thought showed the limitations right now. The ceiling's there for guys like Gabe Brown, like you said. The ceiling's there for Rocket Watts, but man, they're going through some struggles right now that's holding this team back.
So we've still got over half the Big Ten season to go, obviously. So where do you guys think this team is going to end up finishing, maybe record-wise or, you know, their final place in the standings in the conference? Or even if you want to extrapolate that even further, the NCAA tournament. I mean, if you look at a lot of the projections, I don't think anybody's worried about them making the tournament. I mean, I think they might be on the bubble, but they're on the much better part of the bubble if there is such a thing that exists. Although I have seen a couple projections that have them out of the tournament, but I think those aren't any of the quote-unquote major ones. But, where do you guys see this team finishing?
Well, I wrote a column on this weekend because I do think it's legit, the bubble. Not that this is his best bubble team. And, you know, but, you know, they were 84 in the net coming out of that game. And the thing about the Big Ten that's great for MSU is that there's so many quality win opportunities. And there are almost no bad loss opportunities. And so you're not going to have to be, you know, if Michigan State gets to 8-12, overall, 14-12, or 8-12 in the Big Ten, 14-12 overall in this year, I think that probably gets you in, depending on, you know, just looking at the league. But if you look at what's directly ahead, there's a real chance they're 3-7 the way they're playing. Now, they may beat somebody like Iowa or Illinois or whatever. Illinois, you can't trust at all. But if they're 3-7 after 10, they're probably going to have to go 5-5 in the back half to be sure they're getting in. And while I think they probably will, and I think this season is more about them than other years, I think you're still going to have to beat some people. There's no doubt about that. There's just, you know, and who are they going to beat and who are they better than? And, this is a team that you don't trust yet. The thing is, I think they're talented enough that they're going to beat some people on given nights that they're going to wind up on the right side of that bubble. I just you can't be sure because the Big Ten is so tough this year that if you wind up losing confidence, it can be a bloodbath, you know, game after game.
Yeah, you can't lose those games to teams like Purdue and Minnesota either from here out. Those teams that are, you know, fringe top 25 or pretty decidedly out of the top 25. I look back, they've started twice, I think, 2-4 in the Big Ten under Izzo, both of them during a 16-game season. And I think they were in back-to-back years in the early 2000s. They started 2-4, but they finished 8-2 in each of those years to play themselves into the tournament. It's the 20-game schedule helps and hurts in some ways because, man, it's a gauntlet. I mean, those teams that, you know, you can't, there's no really bad Rutgers or Northwestern type team for the last 5 years out there, I don't think. I mean, Northwestern has had its ebbs and dips, but I think that, you know, all these teams are flirting with the top 25 for a reason because it's a deep league. And we've talked about this for a few years now. The coaching is at an insane level. I mean, you know, it's probably the best and deepest the coaching pool has been. You know, I mean, you know, obviously the Penn State situation is one that's still up in the air without Pat Chambers moving forward. But, you know, the rest of the, I mean, even Pat Chambers built that program to a point where they could have been an NCAA team last year. So, you know, I think about, just what they've got to do down the stretch. And, you know, ultimately, you got to iron out your own problems. I mean, you're going to be on the bubble until you get, if not things fixed, you have to figure workarounds for things that are issues and ways to minimize. I think that's one thing that Izzo did the last 2 years really well. Around this time of the year, they figured out where their strengths and weaknesses are, and they played to them That's why you saw the big runs in February and March the last 2 years. This group is, I think, going to be a little bit more challenging because I don't think there's really those same kind of defined strengths right now, because the defined strengths that you think are there are Rocket Watch and Joey Hauser, and until they get right, you know, it's going to be a crapshoot.
Yeah, and you've got losses to two bubble teams really right now. You know, I think Purdue and Northwestern are you know, when you talk about 10, 11, whatever, getting in, Purdue and Northwestern are likely to be bubble teams. And so, you know, those are things you don't want, and they prove that Michigan State really doesn't. You know, I can see Michigan State losing at Maryland, who's already beaten Illinois and Wisconsin, but those are their only two wins. You know, those sort of things are, you know, interesting. I mean, the whole league is fascinating. What Michigan State has going, when you look at other years they've been on the bubble. And when I mean being on the bubble, I don't mean they went into really only in 2011 when they had that, you know, most talented team that fell apart completely from number two in the country preselason. Have they gone into Selection Sunday on the bubble? But I'm talking about being on the bubble in February at some point. And they were in 2014-15. You know, they were in Neitzel's junior year. And, you know, there are years where the bubble is misery, and there are years where the bubble is fun. Like, if you know, the Neitzel junior year, I think people enjoyed it. It was relative to expectations that year. The program was established. It was about keeping the streak alive. They had that win over Wisconsin that was number one at the time. You know, the problem for this team is that's never where that's going to go. People aren't, you know, part of the problem with beating Duke early, even if it's the equivalent of Michigan beating Minnesota in football, where you just, it blows up expectations and morons like me start making all sorts of proclamations, that it's difficult to reset what truly is. I mean, Duke, that win, I'm not saying it hurts this team, but Duke is not helping this team. They're not very good. They don't look like they want to play. Krzyzewski doesn't want to play. And that win and how it looked and what it did for expectations in that moment, it's very hard to reset those and say, okay, this is going to be a different kind of year. When, if you're looking at the big picture of the program, this does not look like a team that can win a national title. There are many good things that are coming out of this right now. The fact that other than Joey Hauser, other than Aaron Henry, I should say, other than Aaron Henry, who I think will leave for the NBA next year, Joey Hauser and Watts look like they're due to need more time. And I don't know if Hauser, to what degree Hauser's an NBA guy, but either way, two guys that I thought might and still could put their names in. We'll see what, you know, I never know with Watts or whatever, but and how the season unfolds. But all of a sudden now you talk about Max Christie coming in and the guys coming in next year, and you get those guys back. You know, like when you start looking at big picture, there are things about the struggles this year that could actually help this if you want to look at it from a positive standpoint.
Unless, of course, the big issue there is the what happens to the guys that you think maybe will reclassify in Bates and Boyake. I mean,
well, Boyake looks like a guy they need right now, doesn't he? Like, he looks like a guy they maybe, yeah, like, dude, yeah. And I don't know.
There's to do that, you know, you would have to have some roster attrition. And
if you have
Watts and Hauser, who you expect to potentially go, then someone else is going to have to go if you expect those two big guys to come.
But there is no way that, like, I think Kithier is in it for the long haul. He understands his role. Izzo likes him. He's always going to have a role, right?
Right.
You know, and a guy like Sissoko is a young player who, you know, I mean, he's shown some flashes. I don't think there's any. But I think, you know, with Marble and Bingham, I would be stunned. I wouldn't be surprised if both of them left, but I would be stunned if both of them return next year if Boyacki's coming in. And the idea that, you know, they're just, it's clear that there isn't, these guys are going to be juniors and seniors a year. Now, again, they can stay as long as they want based on the free year with COVID and everything right now, but, or say an extra year, I should say, but I would be surprised if both of those guys, you know, are thinking, I want to ride it out here. I think they're going to look for an opportunity where they can play if this year doesn't unfold well for them by the end, you know?
You'd still need two scholarships is what I was going to say. I mean, if you want to get both of those guys in.
So wait a second. Do the math with me real quick here. So if they lose, I'm blank on this. They're one down now. They've got one sitting there. They would lose. Henry, we're saying we're assuming Henry is going to go. They could lose Langford. So that's
three. That's your three guys that are coming in right now with Baylor, right, with Akins, Christie, and Brooks.
Right.
You'd still need two.
You still need two. Yeah. No, it will get interesting. And what's funny is that's one of the reasons I think with Boyacki, they basically said, we're still thinking 2022 with him. But it's also becoming crystal clear that that's a position where they may need most right now. I'm not Sissoko may, by the time he's a sophomore, feel that. Sissoko, Kithier, and one of the two guys, Marble or Bingham, might be fine a year from now. I could also see both those guys deciding, they wanted something else. And I think, the way you do that if you're Izzo, it's easy. It's right now Sissoko is the first big off the bench often. And if Sissoko becomes the alternative to Kithier, clearly, where those two are playing the most minutes, and then you signal to those other guys what your plan is, and I would be surprised if they didn't read that,
But you also have Lawyer too, and I think that's kind of the wild card. I mean, they discussed that they talked about having discussions about him leaving going into this off season, and now you bring in Akin as a point guard. You established Hogard as a potential guy to be your backup. What's the role for him?
And also for Lawyer, I mean, think of it from this perspective. I mean, the COVID year has really for him been a godsend in this, that this is a free year, and now you're probably going to be able to transfer without penalty. So Lawyer is going to be able to go play, instead of a grad transfer, he's going to be able to play 2 years somewhere else if he wanted to.
Right.
And so the penalty is nothing. And he could go play in the MAC or Horizon League or someplace else that wanted him.
He could become Travis Bader.
Yeah. I mean, he's – a different player, but absolutely a guy that I think, there are, don't get me wrong, wherever he goes, defensively, he will not be an asset at Division I. There are lots of quick, good guards at the mid-major level who will devour him and that's an appearance thing. I think that'll be an interesting thing with him. You're right. That's a really good, it's a really good question, because he's a captain. He's a guy who's found a role, and I do think that if you told Foster Lawyer, as a senior, you will also be in this sort of role where you're playing 15, 20 minutes, he might be inclined to stick it out. But if you don't know that's going to be there for you, you might decide that you want to go. And also, do you want to be a star one more time in your life, or at least have more of a green light and more of a bigger role on a team? You can go do that.
All right. Well, let's move on to our very last segment here of the podcast, and that is predictions. We got two games coming up here, Thursday at Iowa and then Sunday against Indiana. Well, let's start with Iowa. Graham, how do you foresee this game turning out?
Not awful, but not great. I think I do not hate the matchup for MSU, and I think they'll be in the game largely. I think they're going to have problems with guards, and it'll depend on how Iowa shoots, but Iowa doesn't defend at a great level. I think it'll be a high scoring game. I think Iowa pulls away late, but so I would say something like, an 80, I would put it like 80, 84 to, or 80, not a little higher than that, 87, 76 sort of game for Iowa.
Yeah. Iowa gives up a lot of points. But they also score a lot. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see if Michigan State can get out and run, because I think I think of the games the last couple of years that they've played at Carver Hawkeye, that they've been able to kind of go in there and disrupt what Iowa does well and frustrate them. But I think that this Iowa team is just at a different level with the veteran presence that they have and scoring presence. So I think they're going to, I'd probably put it in maybe like a 16 point range for Iowa, and a lot of points for, Luka Garza. A lot of points for Luka Garza.
All right, that's two predictions for two losses for the Spartans. And, Chris, will they rebound Sunday with a win against the Hoosiers?
Yeah, I think so. I think that one of the things that will help is facing Garza and kind of is a different kind of big man with Trace Jackson Davis. But I think that, you know, that boom, boom, boom of Williams, Garza, and then Davis will have them a little better equipped to prepare to stop him and try and make the guards that I think are pretty mercurial for Indiana try and beat you. I think, you know, I could predict this maybe not necessarily a final score like the Rutgers, but I could see them defensively clamping down outside like they did. And I think Michigan State wins that one by about eight.
You know, Indiana's given them fits in recent years, so there's that. But
there is that. Yep. I think it caught them last year.
Yeah, but I don't love this Indiana team either. I don't love their – I mean, but, you know, that's the – one of the challenges for Michigan State right now is there's nobody you look at in the Big Ten other than Nebraska and maybe Penn State. We'll see how they come out of all of this. And say that's a game that I would feel comfortable betting them on a money line, right? there's just nobody. And that's their problem right now in finding enough wins. And you're right, Chris. It is much about them and getting to a point that they – solve that. I guess I would pick them to beat Indiana just because I'm not a huge fan of this Indiana team, and it'll be home I wouldn't bet a nickel on it.
All right, any final thoughts before we check out of here for this week?
Oh, I already checked out this week. Are you kidding me?
Everybody be safe, that's all.
All right, thank you for joining us for this edition of Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and the USA Today Network. If you enjoy this podcast and the work surrounding it, please consider subscribing. You can follow our coverage at lsj.com, freep.com, and on Twitter at Graham_Couch, at Chris Solari, at Phil_Friend, and at LSJ Greenwhite. Thanks for listening.